Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Coming up today, Plimpton. 10 years after his death, a documentary celebrates the father of participatory journalism, George Plimpton, who turned his failures as a trapeze artist, a pro boxer, a last string quarterback, and a major league pitcher into stories for the everyman. But first, high school confessional, the digital edition. Teenagers and young adults often get stern warnings against oversharing on social media. One incriminating photo or post could torpedo a college or job application, after all. Now students across America are turning to online confession pages. These are anonymous forums for relaying painful experiences and grievances and other bearings of the soul. Justine Sherrick is West Coast editor at BuzzFeed.com, and she wrote about high school confessions pages and joins us now with more. Justine, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, Virginia. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
What kinds of things do you find on confession pages?
There is a big variety. The main stuff is things that you would expect, like crushes that people have on each other, venting about things like the popular kids or fake friends or that they don't like school. And then there are actual confessions about things like people cheating on their girlfriends or doing drugs or cheating on tests. And then there's also the more sort of touching things about students who are trying to come out of the closet, or really sad things about other students that are dealing with problems like depression and eating disorders.
And these are open to all. So could you walk us through the process? I mean, how are these sites set up? Who moderates them? Because people have to identify themselves on Facebook, right?
No, this is all done anonymously. So there will be anonymous admin who is usually an upper grade student, but no one knows who they are. And then another student can send in a confession through either SurveyMonkey or Google Docs. So it's not tied at all to their identity. And then the admin then decides if they're going to post it or not. It seems like the majority does go up there. If you like someone's post or you comment on someone's post, then your name is tied to it, but otherwise it's completely anonymous.
Reminds me of that very popular post secret site. Do you remember that, where people post that they're sort of outsiders, like the closeted gay kid or the sexually abused child or anorexic kid? And sometimes they get support from it. So do schools encourage this kind of thing?
There isn't encouragement from the school themselves, but I was happy to see that there was a lot of support from other students when some students anonymously cited things like they're trying to come out of the closet or they're dealing with depression. And a lot of people said things like, please feel free to contact me, or here are places that you can get help. And I think it was also helpful for students to know that there are people going through this in their school. So versus something like secret site, where you have no idea who they are. If you are thinking of coming out of the closet and you see six other people are dealing with the same thing, maybe it's going to make it a little bit easier. Or you're less likely to talk negatively about gay people or even make flippant comments about depression if you know that there's fellow students, even if you don't know who they are, who are dealing with this.
But of course, high school students are not always known for their discernment and sense of judgment. And last month, a school district in Newton, Iowa, took legal action to ask that a high school confessions page be closed down. Now, they cited that there were students who were afraid to go back to school after bullying. So what about in cases when things are not so supportive and friendly?
Yeah, those stories are horrible. And I think that problems with bullying, though, happen regardless if they're on the internet or not. The internet doesn't create those problems. It just offers another venue. The admins do put up rules against hate speech and talking about specific individuals, which I think helps the students police themselves, but then also the administrator does have the ability to not post those things. I think the school administration would be wrong to try and censor the students, and also they have tried, and then the students just start another site
And Justine, I'm also wondering, I mean, this, since they are open to everybody, there may be a kind of voyeuristic appeal of witnessing confessions in this, you know, our post-Oprah age where unburdening the soul is valued in our culture. You know, how does this change the experience of sort of high school gossiping and high school secrets, do you think?
Oh, I think it makes gossip spread more quickly and further. Students told me about looking at the pages of other high schools. And there's a definite voyeuristic element of that. I remember in high school, there's always gossip going around about other people. But yeah, like I said, this just makes it go further, faster.
Mm. Justine Sherrick, West Coast editor at BuzzFeed.com. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
You can find a link to read Justine's recent BuzzFeed article. It's called The Strange World of High School Confession Pages, and that's at wordofmouthradio.org. In 1995, Wired magazine profiled a new website that at the time was offering free memberships to anyone willing to experiment with online dating. Less than 10 years later, Match.com boasted more than 15 million users and was the largest in an expanding field of websites designed for digital matchmaking. Now, a new study from the University of Chicago shows that couples who meet via online dating sites and who get married tend to have a higher rate of marital satisfaction than couples who meet for the first time in person. Here with more on these findings is Ingrid Wickelgren. She's editor of Scientific American Mind. And Ingrid, great to have you back on Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
Now, it has to be said first that the study you wrote about was funded by eHarmony.com, which is a matchmaking site. How does Scientific American Mind approach a study done by an interested party?
First of all, we become aware of it. And we look into the funding source and whether that compromised the results at all. You know, I determined that it seems legitimate. The researchers sort of guaranteed some safeguards before even agreeing to work on the study. First and foremost was that the results would be published no matter what they said. In addition, they had Harris Polls conduct the research, and they had independent statisticians verify the statistics used to analyze the results.
Well, Ingrid, can you run through us, please, what are the findings of this study?
One of the principal findings is that lots of online meetings result in marriages. More than 30%, they found. That was very interesting. In addition, they found that meeting your spouse online was associated with a lower rate of marital breakups and a slightly higher rate of marital satisfaction.
eHarmony was first launched in 2000. Do you know how many years of data the study was drawing on?
The study was on couples who were married between 2005 and 2012. So what they did was they sent out an online survey to these 19,000 people and asked them about their marriages, you know, whether they broke up, when they broke up, how long did they last, and asked them about their marital satisfaction.
Any kind of theories on why relationships that began online result in better marriages?
Sure. There are many. We don't really know why, first of all, but there are theories. I mean, one of them is just sort of the most common sense idea that, gee, you have a lot of choices right there. How long would it take to travel to all the bars and church functions and wherever else you meet people to kind of, you know, survey your options, right? You know, the other possibility is people feel a little bit more relaxed meeting people electronically. I don't know, paradoxically, studies show that people open up more and they actually like each other more when they meet by a computer. I think another possibility, too, is that when you meet people online, you have sort of a period where you can evaluate them without the emotional commitment.
So there's a little weeding out, a sort of a first pass.
Yeah, right. I mean, sometimes it's hard. You get into some kind of relationship after you've met a person and there's all this emotional connection here you don't want to break. And possibly there's a little bit more rational thinking up front.
How about the demographics of people who use online dating sites? Might that influence the results of the survey and success in marriage?
Yes, it's very possible. In this case, what they found, actually found something interesting. They found that it's the younger people, the people who are more likely to be employed. Of course, the busier people who tend to go on these sites and meet their spouses online preferentially. And you might think, well, you know, these are people who maybe they're better marriage potential or something, right? They did actually in the study try to control for those demographic factors. But of course, there could be other things that go along with those sort of demographics that they couldn't control for, maybe personality factors such as, I don't know, increased willingness for commitment or better decision-making capacity. It's hard to know the most obvious demographics they controlled for, but they're also very interesting to me to see who is finding their spouse online.
It seems like over the past couple of decades, when people have talked about meeting online, dating online, there has been a kind of a level of stigma, you know, and now that it's been going on for more than a decade, we see results like this, fewer breakups, more satisfaction within marriage. Do you think the online dating thing is finally losing any of the stigma it may have had?
I think it might. It's a little hard for me because I've never done it. So it seems still a little foreign, I think, to people who sort of are from the old days. But I don't see how it couldn't lose its stigma if so many people are doing it and it's resulting in good relationships, which is, of course, what we all want.
Thank you so much for joining us, Ingrid.
Thanks for having me, Virginia.
Ingrid Wickelgren is editor with Scientific American Mind. We do have a link to read her article, Does Finding Your Spouse Online Lead to a Stronger Marriage? That's at wordofmouthradio.org. We asked listeners on Facebook for their thoughts on online dating and heard from a first wave couple who met on CompuServe way back in 1990. Another woman who met her SO in the late 90s on Usernet said maybe we shouldn't feel so sheepish about meeting online. And we'd love to hear your experience, however it turned out, and your thoughts on how meeting online is different from meeting in person. You can join the conversation on our Facebook page at Word of Mouth Radio.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. In a nation that values achievement, George Plimpton failed fabulously.
For those of you who haven't heard of Plimpton, it's a little difficult to know where to begin an introduction. Plimpton's a writer. He is an editor of the Paris Review. And after that, he's a collector of experiences. Experiences like boxing Archie Moore, playing quarterback for the Detroit Lions, or percussion for the New York Philharmonic, the list could go on and on. It's obvious, of course, that no one could be that good, and Plimpton certainly isn't.
60 years after he helped launch the Paris Review, and 10 years after his death, George Plimpton does what he does best, plays himself in a new documentary. The man who threw himself into the ring with a professional boxer, played goalie for the Bruins, and quarterback for the Detroit Lions, effectively created the participatory journalism genre, giving mere mortals a glimpse of what it was like to play with the Giants. Filmmakers Tom Bean and Luke Poling combed through hours of footage to create a film of clear adoration, posthumously narrated by its own subject. Plimpton, starring George Plimpton as himself, is already out in select theaters. And Tom Bean, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Luke, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having us on.
Well, George Plimpton came into the world with quite a heavy legacy. He came from this very patrician family, probably responsible for that very distinctive voice. But he never quite lived up to his family's, or certainly his father's, expectations. What kind of effect did that have on him?
Everyone says that he didn't live up to his father's expectations. But really, when you look at what he accomplished in his life, I don't know what parent was expecting their child to play horseshoes with the president and appear as himself on The Simpsons and do all the other amazing things that George did throughout his life. His father came from he was a lawyer at a very large firm in New York, and George kind of went another path.
Tell us a little bit about his Art of Fiction, which was really his invention for the Paris Review, something that in your film, Philip Gurevich says, a genre he really invented.
The Paris Review interview has long been the kind of culminating interview of an artist's career, because they don't simply sit down and ask a question and transcribe it and print it. What they do is they collaborate with the artist themselves. So the Kurt Vonnegut interview, for example, took 10 years to do. The writer who they're interviewing edits what they say. The idea isn't to catch them out. The idea is to have them say their definitive piece about their craft. And they only pick people who are kind of later in their career, canonical writers. They kind of enter the canon when they do their Paris Review interview. Immediately, everyone copied it. Obviously, the Playboy interview, the Esquire interview, this kind of Q&A style where you transcribe it and print it, that became a widely adopted format that George essentially created in 1953.
One of the interviews that was really represented the coup for him was with Ernest Hemingway. Here he is telling an audience about the experience of that interview.
I said, Papa, what's the symbol of the white birds that seem to appear in so many of your sex scenes? And it was as if I'd stuck him with a pin. He turned red with sort of with rage, and I put down the picnic hamper somewhat alarmed, and he shouted at me, so you could hear it for half a mile. He shouted at me, "So you think you can do better?" I at this time had written a children's book called The Rabbit's Umbrella. He was a Nobel Prize winner, so there's really no way that I could answer this question.
We hear in the film about George's sort of search for his father or papa. What did that interview mean for him, do you think?
I think George certainly looked up to Hemingway and admired him, as so many writers of that era did. In fact, I think a lot of them really ended up in Paris because they wanted to, you know, like Gay Talese says in the film, emulate people like Hemingway and Fitzgerald and the generation before him. So for him to get Hemingway, who was notoriously reticent to talk at all about his craft, and really to get what ended up being the one really big interview that Hemingway gave in his life. For George, I think it was a huge success, and especially at that time, I believe it appeared originally in issue 16 or 17. So the magazine had been around for a couple years, but maybe didn't have the status that it has today. James Salter, one of the people we interviewed, said that, you know, their list of people who have done it is as prestigious as you know, the Nobel Prize for Literature or the Pulitzer.
James Salter is one of these people who has some criticism for the other side of George Plimpton, which was this much showier, the participatory journalist, the man who was writing for Sports Illustrated and throwing himself into these experiences. Tell us about his first foray into participatory journalism.
So George, when he moved back from Paris after founding the magazine to New York, he started writing for Sports Illustrated, which was a fairly new magazine at the time and had huge literary credentials. I mean, people like Faulkner were writing pieces. It was an era of adopting literary forms to popular genres like sport. And George threw himself into this gleefully. He was really excited about participating. What he was hoping to achieve, clearly, was to get inside the huddle. He wanted to illuminate the closed worlds of performative genius from within and discover the talent it took to do it, the skill, the hard work. And his very first piece was to pitch at a baseball all-star game at Yankee Stadium, which he claimed was every young American boy's dream. And he gets in there and he gets Willie Mays to pop out, and he decides, gosh, this is it. You know, I've made it. I'm going to be a pitcher. And then, you know, Ernie Banks hits a line drive. And then this guy, Frank Thomas, who played for the Pirates, you know, took him to the upper deck of Yankee Stadium. And George just stood there flabbergasted, his arm about to fall off, just saying, well, I guess that's why they're the pros, you know? And so he wrote this wonderful essay for Sports Illustrated. He turned that into a book called Out of My League, which actually he got Hemingway to blurb. George, as a humorist, had the good sense to set himself up to fail. And it created this neat story arc where he could get into the world. He could learn about what it took to participate. He could learn from the people. And then he failed, and he had this great story arc, whether it was baseball or the New York Philharmonic or the circus or whatever it was.
And he also fought with the light heavyweight champ of the world, Archie Moore, a man known as Mr. Mongoose. Here is George Plimpton recounting that story. This is from the film Plimpton.
Well, as you can see, I am not properly constituted to fight. I have a very thin, delicate nose which bleeds.
And not only that, but I suffer from something called sympathetic response, which means that if you're hit, you weep. Well, the fight started, and in the first round, Mr. Moore made these really very aggressive moves and stuck out a couple of extremely stiff jabs. There was an enormous amount of sympathetic response. And I think it sort of startled Archie Moore. He'd never been in the ring with somebody both bleeding and weeping at the same time. And sympathy overwhelmed him. Kept hauling me up. He kept whispering in my ear, "Breathe, man, breathe."
That's a clip from the film Plimpton, starring George Plimpton as himself. I'm speaking to directors Tom Bean and Luke Poling about the movie and about the colorful, wonderful character that is George Plimpton. Why do you think that so many people were following these kind of crazy antics?
You know, George said at one point that the vast majority of American males put themselves to sleep at night striking out the Yankees batting order. And it's something that when you watch the game on TV or even in person, you're always looking at it thinking, well, I could have thrown that pass. That wasn't that great a catch, or that goal wasn't that spectacular. But George going in there and actually putting his neck on the line, you see very clearly that it does take a special talent and a special skill to be able to work in these worlds. And George had definitely an innate athletic ability, but, you know, very quickly showed that it was nowhere near what these other professionals had. And on top of that, I think he really did a great job of bringing you into the huddle. He talks in Paper Lion about literally standing in the huddle and seeing all these pairs of shoes pointing at him, looking for him to make a decision. And for sports fans to be able to read any of his books and feel like you are in the locker room with the Bruins or you're on the field with the Lions, it's a kind of immersive journalism that's kind of new. And George, he's kind of the perfect person to take you by the hand and lead you into this very exciting and very interesting kind of closed world that you hadn't seen from that angle before.
One experience that George never talked about was being with Bobby Kennedy when he was shot. You get tape of his deposition to, I'm guessing it's the Los Angeles Police Department. Let's hear just a bit from that.
Could you describe him?
Curious. I know. Being a writer, I think one would think one would know these things, and yet, goddammit, I can't tell you. I think his shirt was yellow-brown, but if you tell me it wasn't, I wouldn't be the slightest bit surprised. I can tell you all about his eyes. They were dark brown, enormously peaceful eyes.
Why do you think he never talked about that story? You know, perhaps the strongest experience or the most powerful experience in anybody's life that I can imagine.
I think it was just devastating for him. I mean, like that clip you just played, you can clearly hear how utterly destroyed George is from having witnessed this. And he was good friends with the Kennedys. He dated Jackie when they were teenagers. He was in the same graduating class at Harvard with RFK and was appearing on the campaign trail for him, you know, that the year he was assassinated. And the other things that George wrote about were all things that he kind of knowingly and willingly undertook. And this was something just so horrific and so terrible. I think it was difficult for him to really process it. And the amount of time and effort you would have to spend thinking about it and really trying to verbalize it and put it down on paper, I think just proved to be perhaps too painful for him to relive.
Another role that he, I think, had some difficulty playing was as a husband and a father and even a brother. Members of his family, both his first wife, Freddie, second wife, Sarah Dudley Plimpton, his son, his daughter, his sister, most all of them comment about George seemed to belong to everybody. He loved the party. He loved to be the center of attention, but intimacy was a little bit more challenging for him. As you guys made the movie and went through all of these hours and hours of George Plimpton tape and lines of text, what was holding him back?
Well, I think, you know, George as the great extrovert also means he's slightly aloof from certain elements of his life. I think the flip side of the guy who goes everywhere, does everything, knows everyone, is that he doesn't have an opportunity as a person to spend a whole lot of time with, you know, one group of people or one person. You know, everyone said he was an affectionate man and a loving father, a very supportive father. But I think that because he was always on the fly, being George Plimpton, I think that may have left a certain space there that, I don't know, perhaps left his family members and even his other friends kind of wanting more.
We're speaking with Tom Bean and Luke Poling. They are the filmmakers behind the film Plimpton, starring George Plimpton as himself. It's a new documentary. George Plimpton was extremely successful at leveraging the medium of television, both in his documentary and TV specials, you know, where he'd go off to Africa and be a photographer, where he would, you know, be in a John Wayne movie or joining the New York Philharmonic as a percussionist. They would make television specials about this. Became very well known for that. Also, later in his life, he was supporting the Paris Review and his other projects by making commercials.
I'll try almost anything. So when Mattel Electronics asked me to compare their Intellivision games with Atari, I gave it a try. I compared Atari baseball with Intellivision and found Intellivision played much more like real baseball.
Then I compared. This is a part of his life that a number of writers, you know, who would die to get into the Paris Review, probably considered a little bit less than savory. He's accused in the film of being a dilettante, a dabbler. James Salter suggests that he was sort of limiting himself by writing in a genre that doesn't permit greatness. On the other side of things, we hear his second wife say he was a performance artist. You know, he just did everything. What are your observations of that as filmmakers?
Well, I think the premise of George being a dilettante is rested on the false premise that the participation was the end result. And I think that if he just, you know, stormed in and pitched at Yankee Stadium and that was it, you know, yeah, that's dabbling in dilettantism. But, you know, what he did is he used the experience as a device to write. And he was a terrific writer. And moreover, George was part of a movement of journalism, now called New Journalism, or even called then at the time by Tom Wolfe, and his contemporaries, Hunter Thompson, Joan Didion, Tom Wolfe, Gay Talese. I mean, there was this amazing crop of phenomenal writers that really threw out the who, what, when, why, you know, story of so-called objective reportage and decided to inject it filled with like the literary toolkit of quotation and allusion and stream of consciousness. And they threw themselves into their stories and they covered them in a way that no one really had. It's had a major impact on journalism. I think that that's a format that's been ubiquitously adopted now. So I think that George and his contemporaries in action journalism had a much bigger impact on changing a medium than any of the novelists of the mid-century. You know, I think Luke and I wouldn't have made a film about someone that we didn't think was a very good writer. But, you know, the way we had the film unfold was that we wanted to present it, hear the arguments, hear the criticisms of him, and just put his writing out there.
Tom Bean, I want to thank you so much for joining us.
Cheers. Thanks so much for having us.
And Luke Poling, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Tom Bean and Luke Poling filmed, wrote, and produced the film Plimpton, starring George Plimpton as himself. For more on the film, including where it's screening, you can go to wordofmouthradio.org.
Applause began to sound from the stands, and I looked up, startled, and saw people standing and the hands going. It made no sense at the time. It was not derisive, it seemed solid and respectful. What? What, I thought. And I wondered if the applause wasn't meant for someone else. If the mayor had come into the stadium behind me and was waving from an open-topped car. Some of it was, perhaps, an appreciation of the lunacy of my participation and for the fortitude it took to do it. But most of it, even if subconscious, I decided was in relief that I had done as badly as I had.
From the outside, Doctor Who is pretty strange. The protagonist of the BBC's long-running series is a space-traveling alien whose adventures can take him anywhere in the space-time continuum.
I'm saving the world. I need a decent shirt. To hell with the raggedy. Time to put on a show.
Matt Smith, who plays the current incarnation of the Doctor, announced that he plans to leave the series this winter. Mac Rogers is a Brooklyn-based playwright and culture writer who contributes to Slate's Doctor Who TV Club. He spoke with Word of Mouth's Zach Nugent about the question many fans are now asking. Should the next Doctor Who be played by a woman?
The fact of the matter is the role has been portrayed in the television show proper 11 times. Matt Smith, who will be leaving the role this coming Christmas, is the 11th actor to have portrayed the Doctor. All 11 actors have been white males. So for, I'd say, a certain amount of the public, the Doctor has a kind of a locked-in image as a white British guy. For my own money, I would say the only one of those that's a must is the British one. I think the Doctor's got to be British. Other than that, I'm totally open to the idea of, you know, a Doctor who's a person of color or a Doctor who is a woman. It just hasn't been done before. So it would be brand new. It would be a big change for the show.
Is this a good time for the show to take on this kind of radical reboot?
The way that the show is structured, it wouldn't actually have to be a reboot. To get to one of the basic concepts of the show, the hero of the show, Doctor Who, the Doctor, is an alien from the planet Gallifrey. The people from Gallifrey, they're called Time Lords. They have mastered time travel. The Doctor is the last surviving one after the planet was destroyed in a huge apocalyptic war. Time Lords look exactly like humans. The key difference is that when the Doctor is mortally injured in some way, something happens to him that's called regeneration. His whole body transforms into a different body. This was a very clever thing that they came up with back in the 1960s as a way of keeping the show going after the lead actor, William Hartnell, who was playing the role at that time. After he got a little too old and infirm to continue playing the role, they wanted to continue the series, so they invented this idea that he could transform into a different body. This idea has kept the show going for a very long time, and I like the idea that the Doctor kind of symbolizes everything that's possible. He travels in a time machine that can go anywhere in time and space. I think it would expand upon that idea in a very natural way. The Doctor's body can transcend all boundaries, can be male, female, can be any ethnicity. I think it would be a natural fit for the show.
Well, there's been a lot of debate online about who the next Doctor should be. Could you give us the argument against having a woman be the next Doctor Who?
One is that some people simply feel that the role is, that's one of the defining characteristics of the character is that he's male. The other one, I actually read recently a feminist writer writing, I believe in The Guardian, her argument against it was that one of the cornerstones of feminism is that feminism is sort of seeking for new models of being a man for a new era, sensitive, open, with accessible emotions, and particularly nonviolent. Now, one of the defining characteristics of the Doctor as a character is that he is nearly always nonviolent, with certain exceptions, but that's one of the tenets of his personality, that's one of his principles, is that he has always been nonviolent. Well, this writer argued, why take away from young boys a role model who is a nonviolent man?
Well, the official decision will be kept secret until the last possible moment, but who would you like to see portray the Doctor next?
The two actors that I'm kind of keen on, just based on their work on other shows, and who I think would have a natural facility for it, by actual coincidence, one is a woman and one is an actor of color, and they both are British. One is a woman named Ruth Wilson, who had a wonderful 2-year run as a villain on the TV show Luther. She's got this wonderful intelligence behind her eyes that suggests all these layers of cunning that I think would serve the role really well. And then there's an actor named Richard Ayoade, who was in the IT crowd for a number of years, but he's got a wonderful eccentricity to him. He seems a little bit alien, and I think he would actually be a wonderful fit for the role. But what I'm particularly open to, having said those two names, is the fact is that I had no idea who Matt Smith was when they cast him in the role. Never heard of this guy. He looked ludicrous for casting as a Doctor. He looked like a child. I couldn't believe it. And he turned out to just be magical in the role. And I think that an important thing for all fans is to stay open to the idea that someone they've never heard of will kind of come and make their mark and kind of get put on the map with a unique and magical interpretation of the role.
Mac Rogers there of Slate's Doctor Who TV Club, speaking with producer Zach Nugent. Now coming up, for a brief run in the 1970s, glam rock made it suddenly okay for men to wear blue eyeshadow and parade around in unitards. A pop culture critic tells us why glam rock was so transformative then and continues to be today. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of mouth.
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 From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Glam rock paraded its outrageous way across the stage between the early and late 1970s. David Bowie, Lou Reed in bands like T-Rex and Roxy Music, traded in Mad Men and hippie-era masculinity for flamboyant hairstyles, blue eyeshadow, and platform shoes. Glam originated in Britain, but conspired with America's Me Generation, dropping a glitter bomb of theatrics, androgyny, and gay camp on a country lurching between deprivation and hedonism. Without glam, there would be no punk, no Flock of Seagulls hair bands, no goth rock, and no Kiss. Cultural critic Mark Deary argues that glam was surprisingly radical, planting the seeds of gender play in the minds of middle-class kids, one guitar riff at a time. Mark is author of All the Young Dudes, Why Glam Rock Matters. It's the inaugural e-reader release from the new Boing Boing imprint. And Mark, welcome to Word of Mouth.
My pleasure.
Well, help set the stage for us for the dawn of glam. What was going on politically and socially? This is post the 1960s era of idealism. What was happening?
Well, one thing that I think is important to put our fingers on the nub of is the free-floating mood that was drifting around. And it was one of disenchantment and immense disappointment. The wave of the 60s had crashed and receded, and it had left its scummy residue on the shores of American culture and society. And so in the wake of the Manson murders, the killing at Altamont, there was a feeling that the summer of love had turned sour. And so that sort of threadbare and dispiriting backdrop is the socioeconomic backdrop against which the perfumed Oscar Wildean dreams of glam rock are played out.
I'm just trying to imagine in 1972, David Bowie was on Top of the Pops, the British program. He performed Starman. As you say, the sight of him draping a limp-wristed, nail-lacquered hand around pretty boy guitarist Mick Ronson short-circuited devoutly held beliefs about masculinity. What was being challenged here, and what could that possibly have sparked?
So Top of the Pops is happening in England. England, bear in mind, has a much more flexible definition of masculinity than America does because of the pantomime dame tradition in English music hall in which men play women, and they do it very campily. And so England was prepared for a sort of limper, nancier, more foppish masculinity, if you will, but it certainly wasn't prepared for the sight of Bowie with nail lacquer on, as the English call it, and the only mullet that was ever cool dyed red hot red, this heart-stopping, you know, cardiac arrest sort of rhubarb red at the time. And here he is doing this song about alien invaders who have come to save the kids. And the subtext is clear that gender will be bent beyond repair. And at the climax of the song, he drapes his sort of boneless arm around Mick Ronson, the pretty boy guitar player, in almost a parody of English laddishness, of the kind of pub-crawling, genially brawling manliness that had been the stuff of the English working class for quite a while.
There's a starman waiting in the sky. He'd like to come and meet us, but he thinks he blew our minds. There's a starman waiting in the sky. He told us not to blow it.
The imputation was clear to gays watching, but also to the masses. They didn't quite understand the signal that was being beamed at them, but they got a sense that there was something deliciously outré going on here. And the battle lines were drawn thereafter. Boys who, like David Bowie, were that sort of boy, and you risked getting a good thumping in the locker room or at the bus stop if you, quote-unquote, came out as a Bowie fan. So there was collateral damage among straight men for being a Bowie fan in those days, because clearly to like Bowie was to be, as Bowie put it, a homo superior.
So what did glam rock offer to those fans? I mean, that's a pretty tough road to hoe if you're a kid who, you know, was playing baseball last year and this year is putting on blue mascara to go to school. I mean, what was the draw?
glam is kind of a rebellion, a symbolic rebellion, a ritualized rebellion, a fantasy rebellion, a language of rebellion. And that language is overwhelmingly a gay language. So Bowie borrows from lavender culture, to use the term of art from those days, sort of everything but the burden of being gay, and allows mainstream, middle class, largely straight, largely white, often male fans to have the look and feel of transgression without all of the costs of it. At the same time, it bears pointing out that figures like Bowie and Mark Bolan, and I suppose to a far lesser degree, Brian Ferry of Roxy Music, do give closeted gay teens permission to come out. And there's a very interesting debate in the gay community surrounding the question of gay David versus straight David, because Bowie later on, at the peak of his mainstream straight success, the sort of danceable Dave of the 1980s, the Reagan 80s, around the time of Let's Dance, when he has this ginormous chart-busting success, he gives this appalling interview to Rolling Stone, cutely titled David Bowie Straight, in which he repudiates the statement that put him over the top in 1972 when he said, "I'm gay and always have been, even when I was David Jones." He says, "Oh Lord, I was so young then, I didn't know what I was saying." Mm. And he said, "I've always been a closeted heterosexual," in this Rolling Stone interview. So there's a real question regarding the extent to which Bowie ever really was batting for the other team.
Mark Deary is a cultural critic and author of several essays and a collection of essays called I Must Not Think Bad Thoughts. We're talking about his new long-form essay for e-reader. It's called All the Young Dudes, Why Glam Rock Matters, and it's the inaugural release from Boing Boing's new imprint. Well, I want to get into those gender-bending questions a little bit more. I mean, it was maybe a transgressive and effeminate or androgynous look that Bowie and Mott the Hoople and T-Rex were playing at. And this was concurrent with the liberation struggles of the 70s, you know, feminism and gay rights. Did they play together?
Gay rights and feminism absolutely influenced glam rock. In the 1960s, you have people mouthing all these bromides about liberation struggles, and yet, as hippies are all trying to get back to the garden and they're forming radical co-ops and communes, and you have the SDS crafting the Port Huron Statement and people throwing their bodies on the barricades and so forth, women are always consigned to the kitchen making the brown rice stir fry. There's a lot of lip service paid to rebellion and revolution, but gender roles are still absolutely calcified and fossilized, even within the SDS and various radical movements. In the 70s, one of the untold stories is the changes in straight American masculinity as a result of 60s radicalism and feminism and gay liberation. So one of the places people seldom think to look is places like Penny's catalogs and Sears Roebuck catalogs, and you go back and you look at them, and the outfits that are being peddled to dad on Father's Day are absolutely preposterous. They're these unisex leisure suits, screaming slimline polyester disco shirts that would put the Travolta character in Saturday Night Fever to shame. I mean, this stuff, you know, stacked heel platform shoes. I remember when the youth pastor at my church greeted teens leaving the service in his new outfit, which consisted of platform shoes, hugely flared pants, almost elephant bells, one of those Saturday Night Live pullover blouses with the 5-inch band of elastic at the waist, button open to the third button, luxuriant man fur spilling out, and 3 or 4 gold neck chains. I mean, this is the kind of, you know, it was so pimptastic, it was so screamingly queer, and yet this is the kind of rig you could pick up at Sears Roebuck. And that's really not often remarked upon.
Turn and face the strain. Changes. He's gonna have to be a different man. Time may change me.
Mark, you grew up in the era when we used to sort of listen to albums, sitting down, staring at the album covers. What did those images mean to you? What did that transformative figure of David Bowie in the Ziggy stage mean for you?
There's this idea of the alien or the astronaut trapped in a decaying orbit as the perfect metaphor for any oddball consigned to the purgatory, you know, the cultural Mojave of suburbia. And so Bowie gives us this mythic language to incarnate our sense of disaffection and alienation. That reverberated very strongly with me as a teen. You know, I was marginalized in my high school. I wasn't part of any of the cliques. And I grew up in the southernmost suburbs of San Diego. And my high school was populated overwhelmingly by Malibu Barbies and bronzed Ken dolls come to life. So Bowie was a telstar from an alternate universe, you know, beaming to me a vision of a world in which everybody is weird. And then the delivery system for all this before the advent of the web is magazines like Hit Parader and Cream Magazine and Crawdaddy, and to a lesser extent, the already leprously uncool Rolling Stone, you know, with its growingly scalding infatuation with bloated hulks like a Rod Stewart, you know, do you think I'm sexy and so forth. But, you know, the kind of things were fetishized, they were collected, and then they become screens for the wish fulfillment projections of fans, in which fan and idol become as one, you know, in the screens of your dreams.
Well, Mark, I want to get back to your the title of your essay, which is Why Does Glam Matter? And if we are, maybe even like David Bowie, looking back at those old days of skin-tight hip-huggers and unitards and asking ourselves, what did glam bring to popular culture in America and what's lasting?
I think what makes glam rock particularly fascinating, and I'm not claiming that glam should sit side by side with, you know, the civil rights struggle or the struggle for gay liberation, but I do think it's a cultural cross current that's important in the 70s and whose ripples are still felt. And I think one of the secret histories or untold stories of the 1970s, the ways in which American masculinity was sort of liquefied, you see that most obviously in kind of mainstream disco wear and fashion, but you see it in other aspects of American masculinity. I think we've lost that. I think beachheads can be secured and then lost. And I think in some ways, one of the great ironies of our historical moment now is that you have this incredible extension of gay rights and tolerance of gays and gay culture and an almost growingly blasé or enthusiastic embrace of gays and whatever mainstream straight conceived to be gayness, that sort of elusive quality that seems to be more and more fetishized and celebrated even among straights. And yet at the same time, it seems to me that American masculinity in many ways is as or if not more calcified than ever. So glam rock looks now like a brief moment in time when a window of opportunity opened and then was slammed shut. And I regret that. And part of this essay is not just boomer nostalgia for my gloriously misspent youth, but it's also a nostalgia for all that could have been.
Mark Deary, cultural critic and essayist, his new long-form essay for the e-reader is called All the Young Dudes, Why Glam Rock Matters. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. It's been absolutely delightful.
Thank you for tuning into Word of Mouth this week. We're always grateful for your listening time. And of course, welcome your comments and your contributions. You can send an email to wordofmouth@nhpr.org, post on our Facebook page, or send us a tweet. We would love to hear from you. I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is Word of Mouth from listener-supported New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Zach Nugent,
and Bill Barry.
And senior producer Rebecca Lavoie, with plenty of help from our interns,
Molly Donahue
and Logan Shannon.
Sarah Plord is our digital producer.
And Dan Colgan runs our board.
The views expressed in this program
are those of the individuals,
and not those of NHPR, its board of trustees,
or its underwriters.
To subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows, go to wordofmouthradio.org.
You can also join us on Facebook and Tumblr.
Follow us on Twitter.
And check out a playlist of music from the program
on Spotify.
Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire
Public
Radio.
Revolution stuff. What a drag. Too many snacks.